morning. May it please the Court. My name is Bill Janago, and I represent the appellant in this action, Jay Kim. I'd like to reserve 1 minute of my time for rebuttal. The two convictions that are at issue in this appeal both arise out of the over-the-counter sale of non-prescription cold medication below the single transaction limit set by both federal and state law. There's the January 4th transaction. There's the January 5th transaction. I find it helpful when thinking about the issue here, that sort of set theory or Venn diagram. There's one area where it is clear that Mr. Kim's conduct would have been lawful under 80246 if it was a sale for personal use. No question that the over-the-counter sale of the cold medication was lawful. A sale is for personal use if it's at or below the single transaction limit and is for a legitimate medical use. That's one problem, because if it's over-the-counter...
What's the single transaction limit? The federal law doesn't have a single transaction limit, does it?
It actually did, Judge Berzon. At the time, it was 24 grams. The state limit was much lower. It was 9 grams. And the record establishes...
Was the federal law a reporting issue?
You had to report a transaction that was more than 24 grams. It was referred to as a threshold limit. Below 24 grams, you didn't have to report. Over 24 grams...
Is it automatically illegal under 24 grams to sell it, or you just didn't have to report?
You just didn't have to report.
Right. And
so they still have the same issue, like if you sold 10 or 5, but you had the knowledge or should have known that the person was going to use it, it wouldn't matter how much.
That's exactly right. You could sell 1 gram.
You sell
and if
1.
You go over to the other side of 842C2, I'm sorry. And if you have reasonable cause to believe
that it's going
to be used to manufacture a controlled substance, then it's illegal if it's a half a gram.
Okay, so what is the relevance of the personal transaction, either under federal or state law?
Judge Berzon, I think it contributes to the problem with the vagueness of the law, because if you're someone like Mr. Kim who looks up the law and says, okay, it's 9 grams now under state law, I'm a state pharmacist.
But it's not 9 grams. It's 9 grams that you have to report. He apparently didn't understand that, but that is what it says.
I believe that if it was over 24 grams you had to report.
No,
that's
under state law,
state
it's 9
law.
Grams.
He had 9.
There's no reporting requirement under state law. If you sell more than 9 grams under state law.
Right, but there is, and it's 9 grams.
That's right. That's right.
It's a reporting requirement. And also, it's a reporting requirement. So I don't really understand what the relevance – I understand why a layperson might think it and might be looking for a – I mean, it's a troubling case, because here was somebody it looks like who was looking for a bright-line rule, and unfortunately there isn't one.
And
the question is there some – since we operate under myriad laws without numbers, why does this statute need to have one? Well, I guess that's the question. Why does the statute need to have a number, which is really what you're saying? You need to tell Mr. Kim you can sell up to X amount and that's it.
Because it's an over-the-counter drug is really the problem. That's why you have to tell him, because the law allows it to be sold without asking any questions whatsoever. Mm-hmm. You don't need a prescription. Mm-hmm. You can just walk in. And the experts agreed here. You could walk into a Save-On, to a Walgreens, and you could come in, buy 9 grams, walk out, come back in and buy another 9 grams, walk out, come back in and buy another 9 grams.
Not legally, if somebody was watching and knew what was happening. I mean, what you're saying is that when you have a small pharmacy, and it is troubling, it's more likely that the government's going to be able to prove this up, because you're going to have you're going to be able to ascertain who, that the same people were looking at and had reason to know. And where if you're dealing with a bigger store, they're going to go to different checkout counters, and how's anybody going to know? That's really what your problem is.
It's a vague law. It doesn't give notice as to what you have to do.
It's that it operates differently. It's easier to prove under some circumstances than others.
Well, if you look at it from the perspective of the pharmacist who is supposed to comply with the law, what is he supposed to do? You then have to police every over-the-counter transaction? I mean, think about what happened here. On January 4th...
How about the other is maybe you wouldn't have to, but what if, in fact, you have the situation where here, for better or for worse, because it is a small pharmacy, he knows and sees what's going on. So we're not going to deal with the situation where you don't know what's going on. But he sees guys come in, they say, I want to buy the whole nine yards. I want to buy up all your cold medicine. He says, I can't sell you all my cold medicine. Well, most people who are average consumers with sinus or cold problems don't come in and say, I'd like to buy out your entire pharmacy. I mean, isn't that a tip-off of knew or should have known? And then you've got, they come back the next day, and they ask again for the high quantity, and the clerk says, no, you can't do that.
First of all, on January 5th, which is the second transaction, there's no evidence that Mr. Kim even knew about that.
You're not making a sufficiency of the evidence claim on the second.
No, I'm arguing, I think that I don't get, the point is that under...
I'm wondering why not. I mean, it seems like the second one is very problematic. He didn't seem to see anything. I mean, he has no proof that he did anything except see them.
If I would submit, Judge Berzon, if it's close to a sufficiency of the evidence argument, then it certainly does meet the requirement that it's not clear that his conduct is lawful. I think it's an easier argument. If I was going to show sufficiency, I'd have to show there's no rational basis for the jury's verdict. All I have to do now is show that it's not clearly prohibited by the law. And I don't think that it is. And that's the problem with the law. Because if it was sufficiency, I'd have to show there is no basis. What I do have to show in order to challenge it as vague is that his conduct is not clearly prohibited. When they come in on January 4th, Mr. Kim said that the people who he thought were using this to make methamphetamine were in their 30s, were dirty, disheveled, and have long hair. Who does the government send in? Three beefy, clean, well-dressed, shaved undercover agents. He comes down from his pharmacy counter, intercedes, and says, who's buying whom? What are you going to buy this for? And they give him answers. They say, we have a large family. We use it a lot. They said that to him. He makes an inquiry. It's an over-the-counter drug. What's he supposed to do? Say, no, I'm not going to sell to you? These guys were vulgar. They were using language like blow me. He just wanted to get them out of his store. They even said to him, can we come back tomorrow and buy some more? He said, no. And they said, what about the other day? And what about the next day? He says, we're not selling every day. We're not selling every other day.
And then they come in the next day,
and he
sees them.
There's an acknowledgement. The record is that one of the agents looks at him, and Mr. Kim looks back. There's no evidence that he recognized who they were, that they had. He filled 27,000 prescriptions in the calendar year 2000.
Between day one and two, did he?
I think that the record shows that he filled 65 prescriptions on one of those days and maybe 40 on the other day. But the point is that he was a busy person. He looked at everybody who came in
the
store.
There's no evidence in the second day that he even knew what they bought.
That's exactly right, Judge Berzon. And so I think that we're entitled to challenge it as being vague.
Where Judge Berzon is. It's more of a sufficiency problem. We have two circuits who've looked at it and say, we've looked at it, it's not vague. So you want us to step out from the sister circuits and say, no, you're wrong, it is vague, because why?
No, I'm not asking you to say the statute is vague on its face. And the other circuits, the Eighth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit, do not say that it's vague on its face. They do say it could be vague as applied. And that's all I'm saying here, that as applied to over-the-counter medicine, that's what we're dealing with here. When applied to over-the-counter medicine, you can have a circumstance where it's vague as applied. And that's this case. I'm not asking you to say the law is vague on its face. And those other circuits...
But wait a second. Go ahead.
I mean, what vague on its face means.
That means that in all circumstances, it would not provide adequate notice. If Mr. Kim was...
What does it mean vague not on its face? That's what I don't understand. If you say that if it's not vague in all circumstances... The problem is that it's not giving him sufficient notice given his circumstances. That does seem to merge into a sufficiency problem.
Well, I suppose it does, but then the standard for meeting a sufficiency argument is much higher than it is for showing that it's on the one. If it's a sufficiency argument, I've got the burden of showing no reasonable juror concluded he was guilty. If it's a vagueness as applied argument, the government has the burden of showing that his conduct was clearly prohibited. And I don't think they can do that. Not when you make the inquiry. Not when on January 5th there's no interaction by him at all.
Well, if you believe that he meets the qualifications of the statute, i.e. that he reasonably should have known, then his conduct is clearly covered. So it requires getting into his mind. But let's suppose that in fact, on January 4th, he looked at these people and he said, you know, these people are going to use it to make methamphetamine, but they're under the number, and my understanding is that I can sell to them, so I'm going to sell to them. Let's suppose that was the state of mind. And that's essentially what – would that be clearly covered?
If he thought that he could sell it to them no matter what, even if they're going to use it to make methamphetamine, that would be wrong, and mistake of law would be no defense. But he's told, and he agrees, that if he sells any quantity, knowing or reasonably believing that the person is going to use it to manufacture methamphetamine, he's guilty.
What's wrong with that? I mean, here's where I'm having a trouble, is that what you're really saying is that given the facts here, they shouldn't rise as a matter of law to reasonable cause to believe. I mean, that's really what you're saying.
I think I may be saying that, but what I think I'm saying is that with an over-the-counter medicine, right, this can be sold with no questions asked. When do you cross over from legitimate medical use, mm-hmm. which is clearly lawful, to reasonable cause to believe? It is when someone buys at the limit? Well, that can't be, because the law says you can buy up to 9 grams. Is it when someone...
The law doesn't say that.
If it's for legitimate medical use. What I'm saying, Judge Berzon, is if someone comes in and buys 9 grams at a Walmart and the cash register sells it to them, that sale is illegal if the cash register has reason to believe that it's going to be used to manufacture methamphetamine. It's lawful if the person believes that it's going to be used for legitimate medical use. When you don't have any prescription, what is it that distinguishes between for a legitimate medical use and reasonable cause to believe? And I think
it depends on what you knew. Okay, the guy walks in and says, I need this for my meth lab. How much can you sell me?
Illegal, straight out.
Why?
But
it's illegal. You just told me if it's a
sale
over-the-counter drug, which I can legitimately sell, then it should be okay.
No, it's got to be over-the-counter and for legitimate medical use. My point is that you sell this without asking any questions.
Okay, so then that's part number two. Guy comes in and says, hello, I'd like to buy this. And you say, okay, I'd like to sell it to you. That's part two. Then the question is there something in the middle between, hi, I want to use it for my drug lab, and I'm not talking. And the question is, you're saying that the law can't impose a reasonable to believe between these two because the guy doesn't know what's reasonable and what's not reasonable.
No, I don't think I'm saying that.
Okay.
I think that in most situations, and if you look at the circuit decisions that the government has cited from the Eighth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit, they're easy cases because someone's selling caseloads, they're trying to use suspicious names, they're buying from multiple wholesalers. None of that was going on here. He bought from Bergen Brunswick. That's the only person he bought from.
That's all true, and it's a disturbing case for that reason. But I still have a hard time understanding why it's not simply a question of you, like many other mens rea questions. It's an issue of inferring what he either knew or should have known, and we have it all over the law. It's not why I don't see why it's different than any other mens rea question.
Because there's no guidelines for enforcement, so it's arbitrary. Mr. Kim gets prosecuted. Bergen Brunswick, who was selling him the 24 bottles a day, goes scot-free. Why? Who knows?
Do we have evidence of that in the record, the sort of arbitrary prosecution?
Yes, there was expert testimony from Dr. Weissman, who's dean at the pharmacy school at USC, who said...
there's arbitrary prosecution.
Pardon?
And there's arbitrary prosecution.
Well, but unless it's on a suspect basis...
They couldn't have tried to charge these people. I mean, I don't know what's going on out in the world, but I'm willing to accept your representation that they're more likely to go after small sole ownership pharmacies because they're much easier to prove, and that's disturbing.
Well, let's say Mr. Kim never... He sealed himself off in his pharmacy booth so he couldn't see the retail transaction section. And he told his cash register, as he did, the law says we can sell up to 9 grams in a single transaction if it's for a legitimate medical use. I don't want you to sell more than 9 grams. And that's all he does. And he sells 24 bottles a day.
And he doesn't tell her, and don't sell less than 9 grams either if you have reason to think they're going to use it for a meth lab, which is what he should tell her.
Okay. But he tells her what she has to do in order for it to be to be lawful. It has to be under 9 grams, at or below 9 grams, and it's got to be for legitimate medical use.
You have to not have reason to believe that they're...
So the question then becomes... In the extreme cases, it's easy to know when someone violates the law. If someone is using secret transactions, if they're selling cartons from the back door, if they're purchasing from multiple distributors.
First of all, this is not a vicarious liability prosecution as such. And if it were, we could worry about it. In other words, they're not saying that they were prosecuting him because of what he didn't tell his clerk. Their contention, at least, is that he himself had reason to know this in the particular instance. The second category of case would be more difficult and more troublesome, and we don't have any.
That's right. But my point was to try to illustrate how the law is vague, because it doesn't tell you, if it's an over-the-counter drug, unless you intercede with every transaction, how do you know?
Well, but if he...
What do you have to do?
But in the example you gave, if he doesn't know anything... aside from whether there might be some blind eye because his sales are off the charts, it's the clerk who's in jeopardy here, not your pharmacist, correct?
So that's right. And what does the clerk have to do under that circumstance? The problem is that the law does not tell the clerk, given that it's
okay,
a...
I think we have your point in mind, and we'll hear from the government.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Did he lose his license?
He did lose his license, yes, after 16 years of practice.
He can't go back,
he's barred.
May it please the Court, Greg Lesser for the United States. Your Honor, you have correctly identified what the defendant's argument really is. This is really a sufficiency argument in disguise, which is why so much time...
After the second count, had it been made, should have succeeded, in my view.
The second count?
Yes. I see the January 5th count, I see absolutely no... The fact that the guy smiled at him does not seem to me to be evidence even that he knew who they were, much less that anything else.
Well, as the defense just pointed out...
But it wasn't made, so we don't have to discuss it.
All right, Your Honor. Well, because the court did say that you were troubled by this, and I do want the court to understand that there was a tremendous amount of evidence that we've tried to illustrate in our brief. But let me read briefly from the record. The witness undercover officer testified, this is at GER 79, I'm sorry, 78 rather. Did you see whether he looked at you, I asked. The witness said, yes, we made eye contact. I smiled, waved to him. He nodded to me, indicating that he recognized me. I said, is that how you took it? He said, yes.
And these are the same pharmacy. If somebody goes in and walks in the door, I think it's perfectly plausible that he just smiles at everybody. In fact, he smiled at him the first time, too, as I recall.
Your Honor, and it could be taken that way, but the factual inference, of course, that the jury made.
Is that a fact, how he took it? That's a fact?
Well, no, I mean the inference on the fact.
The only fact. There was no other fact. But let's go on to the merits.
All right, Your Honor. Okay, with regard to that it really is a sufficiency argument, what the defense is attempting to do is take the vagueness doctrine and then apply it to the facts of this case to say, oh, look, there's factual issues about whether this person should have been convicted. Therefore, he could be someone to whose conduct the statute does not clearly apply. If that were the rule for vagueness challenges, every defendant could make a vagueness challenge and just take the standard for a sufficiency case and slide over and just pick the easier standard for the defendant to prevail, the, quote, does it clearly apply to the conduct? That's not the inquiry that's made in vagueness cases. The inquiry that's made is this the type, basically, it's more categorical. Is this the type of offense or conduct to which this statute applies? Not, in this particular instance, does this evidence add up to a sufficient challenge?
I mean, it is troubling, though. I mean, the way he... defense counsel phrases it is, if you're a pharmacist and this is what you sell and it's legal to sell this stuff, it's hard to know when you should not sell it. I mean, that's the vagueness argument. How do I know I'm not supposed to sell this? Guys come in, I don't sell them over the amount, I tell them, look, usually this stuff lasts, So that's just the first count. On that day, is he not supposed to sell?
Let me put it the exact way that the defendant was told specifically. Dennis Ming, a pharmacy inspector, came into the defendant's pharmacy 4 months before these transactions and, quote, to use Mr. Ming's language, got in his face and said, look, if you even think that this stuff is going to be used to make methamphetamine, it is a violation of federal law for you to sell it. That was told directly to the defendant. And on this date, on January 4th, when the officers came in and said, we need something to break it down, standing in front of the defendant, indicating, as the testimony is in the record, towards the pills, standing feet away from the defendant who's watching and interacting with them, and then also buying iodine, also buying hydrogen peroxide. We need something to break it down. We just tried to buy all the pseudo on the shelves. This is clear to the defendant who the evidence clearly establishes knew that pseudoephedrine was, you know, could be used to make methamphetamine. How much clearer can you get to him that, in fact, that's what these guys were going to do with it?
Did you get that evidence in that the wholesaler reported him?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I believe that did come in just as background evidence to, as to how the investigation started.
The numbers are in there anyway.
The
increase in quantity.
The increase came from wholesaler records, and then also the fact the wholesaler representative testified that of these, what they're called, what our expert terms, stock bottles, 100 count, 60 milligram pseudoephedrine, they're typically used to fill prescriptions. The defendant would sell these directly to the general public, and then other pharmacies in his size in 100-mile-wide geographical area. You know, the defendant sold 5,000 of these bottles during the same time period. Two other pharmacies each sold one. Most pharmacies sold none, or ordered none, rather. 5,000 from the defendant's pharmacy.
Was there evidence of what kind of profit he was making on it?
Yes, Your Honor. That's a very good question. The defendant brought in an expert to testify that most of his money was made from prescription sales. Most of his money was made from prescription sales at a profit margin of approximately 11%. This was his accountant. His profit on the pseudoephedrine bottles, he bought them for $280. He sold them for $880. I believe it was $6 a bottle. My numbers might be wrong, but the profit was definitely $6 a bottle. Now, if you think about it, we know he ordered, and these are just the bottles. He also sold blister packs. He ordered 5,000 of these bottles during that time period. $6 a bottle profit is $30,000, and it's at a much higher profit margin than was his prescription sales. So there was a financial incentive to sell these things. And again, I'm only dealing with the bottles he also sold, and his clerk testified that about half the time when people would come in to buy one of these stock bottles, the 100 count 60 milligram, they would also buy two blister packs of 24 count, they'd walk away with a total of 148 60 milligram pills, which works out to just barely under the 9 grams. So yeah, the defendant would sell, you know, just barely under the 9 grams.
I understand although you said that he was specifically informed, that your case doesn't depend on that in any way, right?
No, not his knowledge of the law. No, it does not necessarily depend on that.
So we have to take the case on the theory that he wasn't specifically informed, that he just read the statute, and he was supposed to figure out when he reasonably knew what's difficult about this is that since it's a legal thing to sell, and he has even some, I don't know if he doesn't have a legal obligation to sell it, but if somebody comes in and you say, I'm not going to sell that to you, and then it turns out that this person isn't going to use it at all for methamphetamine, he could have problems then as well of various kinds. So he's in a very it's troublesome that there aren't better guidelines. Because you're putting people in a bad position.
Your Honor, that's, you know, it's a law that does require people who are authorized to sell this. And bear in mind, Your Honor, authorization to sell this is not just for pharmacists. This law applies equally to pharmacists, the authorization that's pointed out by the defendant.
Right, so if somebody comes into Safeway, suppose these same guys walked into Safeway, okay, and they walked into Safeway, and they went out to the cashier and they made the same showing, they put on the same song and dance. I sort of suspect you wouldn't be prosecuting the cashier.
Well, here's the thing.
But you could be on your theory.
You're right, Your Honor. But the difference is this. It's not just the facts of the individual transaction in this case. We know we have a breadth of evidence showing prior to this, leading up to this, what the defendant's knowledge was. He clearly knew that pseudoephedrine could be used to make methamphetamine. Now, your clerk.
So the Safeway.
Well,
and 7-Eleven.
But if your clerk, your individual clerk in Safeway who's selling it, if that person knows and if we could prove it.
But
yeah.
I mean, this actually kind of ties into another question I wanted to ask that Mr. Kim's counsel brought up. Is really Safeway, Save-On, and Walgreens and the big stores can kind of mask this, put in their cash register up to 9, and then it cuts off. The same guy can come in 100 times and buy for cash, and nothing happens. And so their argument is, look, what you're really doing is you're selectively and arbitrarily prosecuting the little guy because it can be pinpointed, while Safeway and Save-On just go about their merry business.
They're
What's
more
your response to that?
Yes, Your Honor. You're right. But that person in the individual store would be more in a position to know and to, you know, have the evidence in front of them and know that this might be being misused. Now, those stores, by the way, as corporations, many of them voluntarily took the step before it was mandated by law of moving all this stuff behind the counters. So at least made it so a potential purchaser had to ask someone for it. And if you have a potential person who comes up and asks the same clerk over and over for it, then that gives the clerk the opportunity.
Now, I noticed in the pharmacy recently that it's not out. Is that why there's a new
statute? That is, because of this problem, Your Honor. Because of this
problem.
But
there's a new statute? Or there isn't?
You know, there's pending federal legislation, I believe, and I think California has already legislated they need to go behind
it. Depends on the store. I mean, some places you can buy it out, and some places you have to ask for it.
That's true, and there are some places where you can use those, you know, like they have at Home Depot, automatic self-scanners where you just scan stuff yourself. But, you know, it's programmed into the computer to the
extent. But what's the response then for the fact that the way this is set up is that you aren't prosecuting the big guys, and it really falls to what is kind of a vanishing artifact, and that's the local pharmacist who gets prosecuted.
And may I respond?
Please.
Okay. Your Honor, the distinction it draws is people who know or have reasonable cause to believe that what they're distributing is going to make methamphetamine or not. And it's not the thing that's concerning about defendant's brief is nobody's trying to target individual pharmacists. And this statute applies to everybody. It applies to every individual. If I'm a 7-Eleven owner, it's the exact same standard. If I am a, you know.
It's the same standard. The question is the claim he raises is arbitrary enforcement, not standard.
Well, as far as the enforcement, it's always going to have to be an individual who's going to be prosecuted by this, so you're always going to have to prove the individual would know. It shakes out, I think, correctly in the court's statement that a person who is in a single store, who's the only person there, for example, is going to be in a much better position to know what they're selling than is somebody in a clerk in a Safeway.
Especially if they're a pharmacist.
And Your Honor, but the thing is, this law does impose upon individuals the responsibility to police their sales. And that was one of the things that was most troubling about the case is the defendant, when he was interviewed, when he was arrested, said, it's not my job to police pseudoephedrine sales. And it is. This law says it is. Thank you.
You've extended your time, but I'll give you another minute for rebuttal if you'd like.
Just 3 points. First of all, the defendant did report suspicious transactions to the local police officer, in fact, the undercover agent in this case. He made 10 to 15 calls during the year of this investigation where he would call him up and say, I think somebody suspicious is here. So that's wrong. The second thing is the cost of the bottles. That's sort of what the problem is here, right? He's in business to make money. The bottles cost him $2 and something. If he buys the blister pack, it's about $4 and something. To the consumer, it really doesn't make any difference. To a small pharmacy, it means $2 more profit. So what does the government do? Aha, that's evidence that he was doing something illegal. Is he supposed to make less money? Would that have made his conduct more legal or less unlawful? And the third point that I wanted to make is exactly the one that you were making before, Your Honor, is there's no guidelines for enforcement.
I mean, who, when are you supposed to sell? When are you not supposed to sell? We had an expert who said you have an ethical obligation to sell as a pharmacist to someone who needs the medicine.
Hasn't that already been decided that it's not vague?
Only that it's not vague on its face. Both of those cases, the Eighth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit, have both left open the possibility and, in fact, applied. If you look at those cases, they applied a vagueness as applied analysis.
Vagueness as applied challenge has to assume the facts as found. And the facts as found are that he reasonably should have known. So the question is whether somebody
I don't believe that that's true, because that's the jury's verdict. They found him guilty of the crime. There's no specific findings that the jury made other than that he violated the law. So you would never have a vagueness as applied argument if the conviction itself were enough to show that the requisite standard was established. But if you look at those cases, they say not vague on its face. Let's look if it's vague as applied. And what they then do is they say, oh, this person was buying from multiple wholesalers. They were selling it in carton quantities. They were using secret names.
Can you give me some example of any kind of statute that's been held vagueness as applied? Frankly, I've never heard of this. I don't know what it means to be vague as applied. I know it exists. Give me an example.
I believe some of the head shop statutes, that when they were originally enacted, which is where this language comes from, back in the 80s when they started to pass paraphernalia laws. And I don't have a citation.
If you have one, I think your time is up. If you have one, you can submit the citation by letter.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank both counsel for your argument. United States versus Kim is submitted.